regulation after regulation.
I think there are outdated regulations that need to be
new
changed.
New government regulations, which were created to protect
the
employees.
The regulations are
$1.8 trillion.
There's a regulation that doesn't make any sense. Why do you keep
it? Is this really the best we can do?
Welcome to the Regulatory Transparency Project's fourth branch podcast series. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Hello, and welcome to the latest installment of the Tech Roundup podcast, which is part of the Regulatory Transparency Project's ongoing fourth branch podcast series. Our Tech Roundup podcasts feature leading policy experts debating the major legal issues surrounding various emerging technology industries and issues. My name is Adam Thier, and I work for the Mercatus Center at George Mason University, and I will be your host for today's episode. On today's show, we'll be discussing important breaking news in the world of online speech policy, with President Trump recently issuing a new executive order on preventing online censorship, which he signed on May 28th. This new executive order followed on the heels of a very public fight between the president and Twitter after the social networking platform added a fact-check notice to one of the president's tweets about mail-in voting. And now a major public policy battle has developed about the wisdom of regulating social media platforms in the United States more generally. To discuss these matters and the new executive order, I'm joined today by two of the sharpest technology policy lawyers I know, Ashkan Kazarian, who is the Director of Civil Liberties at Tech Freedom, and Neil Chilson, a Senior Research Fellow for Technology and Innovation at the Charles Koch Institute. Ash and Neil are also members of the Federalist Society's Emerging Technology Working Group, which is part of the Regulatory Transparency Project. I chair that group. So let's jump right into it. And Ash, I'm going to turn to you first and help us give us a little bit of background about how we got to the point where the President of the United States was issuing an executive order targeting social media companies, accusing them of censorship, and calling for new types of public policy regulation. Give us some background.
One day, hopefully, I can write a book about this. But a quick version would be that after the 2016 election, obviously the public discourse has been way more volatile than it has been before. And since a lot of the public discourse now happens online, the mediums that hosted a lot of that were affected too. We started hearing voices that claimed this conspiracy theory, basically, because there's no empirical data proving it, so that's what I'm going to call it, of anti-conservative bias on across social media platforms. So for the last 2 years, the mainstream voices that picked that up were first Senator Ted Cruz and Senator Josh Hawley, followed him pretty fast after. And they have been steering a lot of different conversations that we can get into later. That has led to the White House last year being rumored to, and when I say last year, I believe it was late 2018, early 2019, rumored to issue an executive order on regulation of social media companies. They didn't. But obviously something was in the works. And so when Twitter made a decision as a private company, and I'm sure it was a very difficult decision to put, I wouldn't even call it a fact check because it wasn't a fact check in its substance. It was a disclaimer that said, if you want to learn more about mail-in ballots, press here. All hell broke loose. Just last week, I believe it was last week of May, it was 27th when it started. Mm-hmm. And so that very quickly turned into the president saying that he's issuing an executive order to protect his First Amendment rights and protect the First Amendment, even though it was not clear how exactly he understands the First Amendment. And then we saw the order being issued and what exactly it had. It was a little different from the leaked order that a lot of the commentators gave their first impressions on, but I'll stop there and we can dive in later.
All right, now let me turn to Neil Chilson and ask you, Neil, to expand a little bit about specifically what's in this new executive order and specifically how it will affect Section 230.
Yeah, so thanks, Adam. So the you can split the executive order into kind of three categories of content. And this was Daphne Keller's analysis, and I thought it was very useful, so I'm going to borrow it from her. There's sections that are purely rhetoric, and this is quite a lot of the EO, actually, that sort of try to frame this as a defense of free speech when, in many ways, it's an attack on free speech. There's another section that is just, you know, highly legally questionable analysis. And then there's a very small section that is, you know, some legitimate questions of law. And I think we can talk about those. But when it comes to Section 230, what this document tries to do is rewrite the law, or more clearly, it tries to direct various independent agencies to rewrite Section 230. Now, Section 230 is a statute. It was written by Congress. It has certain terms that have been interpreted in hundreds of cases by the courts as they've applied this. And what the executive order does is it directs NTIA to request that the FCC start a rulemaking in order to interpret some of the terms of Section 230. Now, Section 230 is not a long law, but it has some terms that have a long legal history at this point, including the good faith sections where in applying some of the exceptions where the question is whether or not the internet provider was acting in good faith in removing content. And what the executive order tries to do is overturn how courts have interpreted that provision by having the FCC do a rulemaking. And that's pretty questionable legally. And I think it doesn't make a ton of sense as something that the FCC even has the authority
Ryan,
to do.
Let me turn back to you, Ash, and as I do, and ask you to expound upon the things that Neil just teed up about the executive order, also want to ask you to help us take just a step back, because you've been following these battles about net neutrality and political neutrality and media platforms for a while now. And there's, of course, a number of different ironies in this debate. One irony is that Twitter itself and other social media companies have been in favor of some sort of net neutrality or neutrality mandates in the broadband context. And now here people are saying they should be applied to social media. And the other irony would be that President Trump and many conservatives now seemingly are in favor of net neutrality regulations they opposed, or fairness doctrine-like mandates that they've opposed in the past. So the whole world's gone a little bit crazy, it seems. And, you know, maybe you can help us frame that in the context of what this executive order proposes.
Sure. So the net neutrality battle has been something that started kind of picking up. It's been a decade of that, but really hot topic it was during Obama administration, actually, and then it went into the Trump administration. And the net neutrality question was what split the bigger tech community. And it kind of separated the edge providers, platforms, from telecoms, because the edge providers kind of sided with, we need to, you know, do overregulate, we need to ask for neutrality, it has to be in the books, it has to be Title II, all these things. I wasn't there when this all happened. I heard it was very intense. However, this battle is still going on. We had Chairman Ajit Pai then, you know, pass his own order. And without getting into details, what I will say is I think on net neutrality, it is definitely common ground that unfortunately no one can hear or come to. And now it's kind of transcending into this new reality of, okay, how do we regulate social media companies? And social media companies are obviously against, anyone should be against demanding that they are neutral. And so there's definitely some irony, as you said, in defining that or how to message that for them and for everyone on the Republican side who obviously oppose net neutrality. And especially since order does say that ask NTIA, which is an agency that's kind of under the administration and it's not independent, to send this question to the FCC that is an independent agency. The same FCC that did look into the net neutrality question, it's going to be a lot of very interesting political gymnastics from the Republican Party to try to justify this. So now the Fairness Doctrine.
Right.
Really quickly, Fairness Doctrine was something that Ronald Reagan vetoed, that was passed through the majority Democratic Congress back then. And it required that broadcasters basically were neutral in amount of time and air they gave political views. And that created really unwelcoming environment for dissent, for radical thought, both on left and right. And Reagan vetoed it. And so, you know, for decades, Republicans were always opposing fairness doctrine. And now we see some, as in Ted Cruz, for example, asking for fairness doctrine for the internet.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's kind of astonishing. And Neil, as I turn back to you, I mean, you can help elaborate on that point. And then also the fact that not only, as Ash suggested, you know, is it delegating a lot of authority to the administrative state to try to deal with some of these things, which is sort of another irony of this, because that usually wouldn't be something conservatives or a conservative president would do. But there's also discussion not only about, you know, what can the FCC do, but then there's this question of what maybe the FTC or state attorneys general can do under the guise of unfair and deceptive practices. And you've had a long career working with the Federal Trade Commission before you left a few years back. And I mean, tell us about exactly what the play is there, how that would work out, whether it would be at the FTC or at the state level. And then also maybe you could answer this question for me, which is that wouldn't this just really empower a lot of trial lawyers to be filing a lot of frivolous lawsuits that, if nothing else, at the end of the day, which also doesn't strike me as very conservative.
Right. I think there are a ton of problems with how the executive order tries to direct independent agencies, not only sort of violations of the Administrative Procedures Act, but also a bunch of just big policy problems. And so the section where the executive order tasks the FTC with doing some things, and I say that a little bit loosely because there were some changes from the initial draft, which was pretty blatantly commanding the FTC to do something. And the final draft that came out, they've added some weasel words in there to make it sound like they're just strongly suggesting that the FTC do something. But what they suggest is something that the FTC already has its full ability to do, which is to look at the practices of these companies to see if there are unfair or deceptive acts and practices going on. And the FTC does this constantly with companies. And in fact, it's done it with pretty much every major tech company already on different issues. And so often in the areas of privacy, the FTC, when there's been a problem that happens with consumer information, will look and see if a company's statements about what it does privacy-wise are being upheld in or if they've broken those promises to consumers. And so I think the hint here of the executive order is that somehow these platforms may have made statements to customers that are sort of contract-like language, almost binding on them, and that if they then do something with content moderation that goes against those statements, that there might be a Section 5 violation. You know, from my time at the FTC, this seems like a really big stretch, primarily because both the deception authority of the FTC and the unfairness authority that the FTC has both have this element of injury that's important, not only as a legal matter, first and foremost, but also as a prudential matter. The FTC it's not a good use of the FTC's resources to bring cases where there hasn't been the types of injury that the FTC looks at, which are, you know, financial injuries primarily, but there can be some other types of injuries as well. And here it's just really hard to see from something like an interstitial that says, hey, if you want to learn more about this issue that this person is tweeting about, go look at it. Go look at this link. It's hard to see what the injury is to consumers broadly. And in fact, when the FTC looks at these issues, especially under the unfairness analysis, it has to compare any injury that might occur against the benefits that would occur. And I would say the FTC would have a really tough time, I think, demonstrating that this type of additional information, this additional context to a tweet would be the kind of injury to, you know, perhaps to, you know, President Trump that wouldn't be outweighed by many benefits to many other people that might be using the platform. And so I just don't see a strong Section 5 case here. The order also requests that the FTC do a report on complaints from consumers and about, you know, bias or takedowns. Again, it's hard to know what would be in that report, but for each of those, they'd have to go through sort of looking at the overall practice of the platform to see if on balance, you know, there's deceptive acts or practices that violate Section 5. You know, I don't want to prejudge that fully, but it does seem extremely unlikely that this is the type of behavior that the FTC should police. In fact, it would probably raise a bunch of First Amendment questions if the FTC were to bring a case based on these types of content moderation practices. Yeah. And then finally, go ahead. I'll talk. I'm happy to talk about the state AG stuff. Just really quickly, it requests that there be a working group set up with state AGs to look at some of these same issues. And again, I think, you know, the state AGs have similar statutes to the FTC in many cases. They're even often called little FTC acts. And so I think a very similar legal analysis would apply to the types of questions that state AGs might look at. And so I just don't think there's a lot of there for bringing the FTC into this under Section 5.
Ash, you wanted to add something?
Yeah, so I wanted to say that the evaluation of the claims that is mentioned is from the anti-bias task force that the White House had, which what they did was they set up a website, and I believe there was also a physical mail-in option where people would just send claims of, this happened to me and I was silenced because I'm a conservative. To the best of my knowledge, they never, you know, went through those. They just kind of collected them and they said, listen, we have 16,000 claims. I mean, someone might have sent something completely random through that form and it counted as, oh, they're using 16,000 as a number to have a weight behind the claims of anti-conservative bias. So sounds like they're expecting FTC and I believe a few other folks to go through all of these. And that's just fascinating. And a really bad use of government resources. And the other thing, I wanted to mention about FTC was in 2004, very, you know, liberal activists asked FTC to sue Fox News for failing to deliver on its promises to be fair and balanced. And the Republican FTC chairman said that there is no way, and I'm quoting, there's no way to evaluate this petition without evaluating the content of the news at issue. That is a task the First Amendment leaves to the American people and not a government agency. So the same is basically true for policing, you know, the fairness of social media. It is not a job for the government. And I believe there was also a more recent lawsuit in Washington State against Fox over their coverage of the coronavirus that was also thrown out for obvious reasons, because government should not police speech.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, Ash. And I think it's something that a number of us have been talking about in the wake of this executive order, is the concern about the potential future backlash or unintended consequences of conservatives opening the door to more speech control in this regard, because for many, many years, that's been a serious concern. And yet there are so many now calls among conservatives about the dangers of supposed social media leftist bias that, as you alluded to earlier, we have a variety of senators and other representatives on the Hill introducing new forms of legislation to try to affirmatively undermine, if not gut, Section 230 or regulate in other ways. Maybe you could just briefly, Ash, mention what's been going on the Hill with that regard, and maybe most specifically some of the legislation floated by people like Senator Josh Hawley and others, and how that plays into this, and whether this executive order, maybe it means nothing, it's just fluff, but it then maybe greases the skids for some sort of legislative activity in coming months or years.
Right. I'll mention just a few, but there have been bad Section 230 bills all around.
Right.
Senator Hawley has had a proposal where he would actually make FTC certify social media platforms if they were neutral or not, and then the Section 230 protection would depend on that. And again, a disclaimer that I feel like we need to keep repeating until it really settles in everyone's mind. Section 230 protects platforms from liability for third-party, i.e. user-generated content. So by the way, Twitter putting that disclaimer under President's tweet is not protected by Section 230. Let me be very clear. So again, one of the proposals Holly had was having FTC be basically the Ministry of Truth. The other one that I just want to mention for fun was him limiting amount of time we spend on social media. This was right before the lockdown. I imagine this would have gone way different and had more outrage if he told people they can be on Twitter or on Facebook or on Instagram only for 30 minutes, and then you have to like keep opting into having more time on it. The big one that passed 2 years ago was the SESTA-FOSTA,
right,
the Stop
right.
Enabling Sex Traffickers Act, which we did, you know, warn everyone, and unfortunately not everyone listened, that it's going to hurt the victims more than it's going to help. And now we see 2 years later that literally no prosecutions were brought under that, whereas a lot of the illegal activity has gone into the dark net, and it's way more expensive and harder to investigate, amongst other things. And then the crown jewel right now is the Earn It Act, that the DOJ has been very actively pushing and supporting in different ways. That has been introduced by Senator Lindsey Graham, but his co-sponsor and co-author is Senator Richard Blumenthal, that basically gives DOJ, it had different drafts, but it gives DOJ this power to create practices, best practices for the industry. But then if you don't follow the practices, again, they take away the immunity. Since the executive order gave DOJ another try at drafting something that would limit or even revoke Section 230, as the president tweeted in all caps, I won't be surprised if something bigger than Earn It Act comes out in the next few weeks.
Yeah, Neil, let me ask you to sort of answer that same question.
Yeah, I mean, I love the point that Ash made about SESTA and FOSTA not benefiting and actually harming the supposed victims. I think there's a direct parallel here. I think the people who are worried that their content is getting taken down by some biased people on these platforms would be surprised at how much faster their content and how much more of their content would be taken down if all of a sudden these platforms are liable for everything that somebody says on them. We saw this direct effect with the fairness doctrine on broadcasting. It created broadcasting that was so middle of the road and boring. And so if you had anything controversial that you wanted to say, especially, you know, if you were on the right, you just couldn't get on mainstream media. And when the fairness doctrine was repealed, when it was taken away, it's no coincidence that that's when talk radio rose up, and that's when conservative talk radio rose up. And so for all those conservatives who actually have found these platforms to be extremely powerful in getting their message out there, including our president, I think they should think very carefully about the possible effects of forcing these platforms to be liable for everything that's said on them. I think it would just make these platforms very risk averse and much more likely to take down conservative content and all kinds of content.
It would make Twitter liable for what a president says on Twitter.
I think that's a great point.
Like, does he really want that? They would delete his account right away, because that's just not a smart business decision, because hundreds of thousands of people would start suing. I mean, opening the floodgates to litigation.
Yeah, Ash, I think this is an important point that I really want to stress. And I think that a lot of people fail to realize that if the liability floodgates were opened, there would be a mass chilling of speech resulting from that, that would almost certainly hurt conservative voices on platforms that conservatives have benefited more from in recent years than anybody else. I don't think it's too much of a stretch to say that in many ways, this current president owes his presidency to the fact he was able to directly connect with the American people via Twitter and other social media platforms and advertising platforms. And that's an amazing thing considering what conservatives had rightly complained about in the past in terms of limited options and choices to directly communicate to each other or to a broader audience. So it's shocking in that regard for me. Another way it's shocking is that it seems like with the tech lash now being so alive and well on both the left and apparently on the right, that a lot of people are forgetting how this might benefit our international footing and how it might help or might hurt our international footing and benefit our competitors. You think about the fact that despite differences between the left and the right on tech and internet policy over the last 25 to 30 years, there was generally a unified vision about sort of American competitiveness and American exceptionalism when it came to the internet and Silicon Valley and the internet revolution being a homegrown success story of innovation at its finest. And now everybody's out to say, let's just dynamite that all to the ground. It seems to me like that's a real step backwards for not just internet freedom, but for American competitiveness, and that the Chinese or the Europeans or others are going to benefit from this. Am I wrong in thinking that, Ash, or is that potentially going to happen?
We are already seeing it in a way. If you look at which platform has added the most amount of users in United States of America, if not the world, I definitely have seen the numbers for United States, it's TikTok. And no matter how many times TikTok says that they're not a Chinese company, they are. Their latest claim in New York Times, I believe, was that they said that the parent company was incorporated in the Cayman Islands, and that's why they're not a Chinese company. At the same time, they have refused to come to congressional hearings because they said that their executives are based in Beijing. They recently hired a very high-up executive from Disney, and they were trying to rebrand themselves. But as far as we've seen, I mean, we've seen content moderators from TikTok say that the Chinese content moderators made the last call. We've seen them remove any criticism of the Chinese government, information about Hong Kong protests and things like that. I can go on and on about this. My point being is we are seeing the rise of the first of many foreign apps coming for the market share. And no matter how hard the decisions about content moderation and many other things and privacy are for American companies, they are using the American values and the democratic values as their leading star. And if that changes, the world is in big trouble.
Yeah, I think that's right. And Neil, I remember, you know, you and I have been covering these issues for a long time now. And I remember over 10 years ago, we were working on some issues related to the FTC's investigation into the quote unquote future of media. And at the time, a lot of conservatives and us included were warning about what were pretty extremist attacks from the hard left, basically advocating things like new types of public media efforts and nationalizing various types of media and communication systems. And, you know, the language they used was about public forums and essential facilities and a lot of other sort of hard left, almost neo-Marxist kind of garbage. And all of a sudden, that rhetoric is taken on new currency, but from people on the right, which is, it really strikes me as an astonishing development in our lifetimes that I did not see coming, honestly. So maybe with your last word, you can comment and sort of comment on the sort of big picture worldview of what's happening and how we can help turn it around.
Yeah, it really is concerning. And I think it's just, I loved your blog post connecting, drawing those lines between those different movements. I mean, it really shows that there is a segment of politicians, and this shouldn't be a big surprise, but who are no longer even giving lip service to the idea of limited government, if limited government seems to be getting in the way of their preferred policy outcomes. And that should be concerning to everyone, if you're on the left or the right, if you're a conservative or a liberal, because that just means whoever's in charge gets to make all of the rules, and that's not the American way, frankly.
Yeah, Ash, I'm going to give you the last word, and maybe I don't know. Is there a word of optimism you can leave us with about what could happen next, or where we can be helpful in terms of turning the tide on this one?
I think the optimism mostly lies within courts right now, because as we look at precedent overall and Supreme Court precedent, it is the conservatives. It is the conservative judges that have led in the protection of the First Amendment. And so I am pretty confident that if this goes to court, any attempts at limiting free speech online will lose. However, I think it is very important to keep having this discussion and honestly this debate in the public discourse, because as far as I'm seeing the coverage and the conversation online, there are so many conflicting and false information that's just being spread by people who want to pressure tech companies. And that is very dangerous, yeah. Because if you change the mind of enough people, laws can get passed and other bad things can happen. And my last word would be what I've been saying this whole time is that the First Amendment protects Twitter from Trump and not Trump from Twitter.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. Well, that's about all the time we have for on today's show. But before we close, I want to encourage all of you to follow Ash and Neil on Twitter or whatever social media platform you choose while those social media platforms are still with us, at least. They are quite active there, especially on Twitter, and I encourage you to follow them. And I'm there as well. And I also want to ask our audience to make sure to subscribe to the Fourth Branch podcast on whatever podcasting platform you enjoy using, and comment on the show and let us know what you think about this issue. That's it for this week. Thanks again for joining us. I'm Adam Thier. Bye-bye.
On behalf of the Federal Society's Regulatory Transparency Project, thanks for tuning in to the Fourth Branch Podcast. To catch every new episode when it's released, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spreaker. For the latest from RTP, please visit our website at regproject.org. That's regproject.org.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.